This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Ocean at the End of the Lane by Neil Gaiman. Written and read by me, Neil Gaiman. For Amanda, who wanted to know. I remember my own childhood vividly. I knew terrible things, but I knew I mustn't let adults know I knew. It would scare them. Maurice Sendak, in conversation with Art Spiegelman, The New Yorker, September 27th, 1993. It was only a duck pond out at the back of the farm. It wasn't very big. Letty Hempstock said it was an ocean, but I knew that was silly. She said they'd come here across the ocean from the old country. Her mother said that Letty didn't remember properly, and it was a long time ago, and anyway, the old country had sunk. Old Mrs. Hempstock, Letty's grandmother, said they were both wrong, and that the place that had sunk wasn't the really old country. She said she could remember the really old country. She said the really old country had blown up. Prologue. I wore a black suit and a white shirt, a black tie and black shoes, all polished and shiny. Clothes that normally would make me feel uncomfortable, as if I were in a stolen uniform or pretending to be an adult. Today they gave me comfort of a kind. I was wearing the right clothes for a hard day. I had done my duty in the morning, spoken the words I was meant to speak, and I meant them as I spoke them. And then, when the service was done, I got in my car and I drove, randomly, without a plan, with an hour or so to kill before I met more people I had not seen for years and shook more hands and drank too many cups of tea from the best china. I drove along winding Sussex country roads I only half remembered, until I found myself headed toward the town centre. So I turned, randomly, down another road and took a left and a right. It was only then that I realized where I was going, where I had been going all along, and I grimaced at my own foolishness. I had been driving toward a house that had not existed for decades. I thought of turning around then, as I drove down a wide street that had once been a flint lane beside a barley field, of turning back and leaving the past undisturbed. But I was curious. The old house, the one I'd lived in for 7 years, from when I was 5 until I was 12, that house had been knocked down and was lost for good. The new house, the one my parents had built at the bottom of the garden between the azalea bushes and the green circle in the grass we called the fairy ring, that had been sold 30 years ago. I slowed the car as I saw the new house. It would always be the new house, in my head. I pulled up into the driveway, observing the way they had built out on the mid-70s architecture. I had forgotten that the bricks of the house were chocolate brown. The new people had made my mother's tiny balcony into a 2-story sunroom. I stared at the house, remembering less than I had expected about my teenage years. No good times, no bad times. I'd lived in that place for a while as a teenager. It didn't seem to be any part of who I was now. I backed the car out of their driveway. It was time, I knew, to drive to my sister's bustling, cheerful house, all tidied and stiff for the day. I would talk to people whose existence I had forgotten years before, and they would ask me about my marriage. Failed a decade ago, a relationship that had slowly frayed until eventually, as they always seemed to, it broke. And whether I was seeing anyone. I wasn't. I was not even sure that I could, not yet. And they would ask about my children, all grown up. They have their own lives. They wish they could be here today. Work. Doing fine, thank you, I would say, never knowing how to talk about what I do. If I could talk about it, I would not have to do it. I make art. Sometimes I make true art, and sometimes it fills the empty places in my life. Some of them. Not all. We would talk about the departed. We would remember the dead. The little country lane of my childhood had become a black tarmac road that served as a buffer between 2 sprawling housing estates. I drove further down it, away from the town, which was not the way I should have been travelling. And it felt good. The slick black road became narrower, windier, became the single-lane track I remembered from my childhood, became packed earth and knobbly, bone-like flints. Soon I was driving, slowly, bumpily, down a narrow lane with brambles and briar roses on each side, wherever the edge was not a stand of hazels or a wild hedgerow. It felt like I had driven back in time. That lane was how I remembered it, when nothing else was. I drove past Caraway Farm. I remembered being just 16 and kissing red-cheeked, fair-haired Callie Anders who lived there, and whose family would soon move to the Shetlands, and I would never kiss her or see her again. Then nothing but fields on either side of the road, for almost a mile, a tangle of meadows. Slowly the lane became a track. It was reaching its end. I remembered it before I turned the corner and saw it in all its dilapidated red brick glory, the Hempstocks farmhouse. It took me by surprise, although that was where the lane had always ended. I could have gone no further. I parked the car at the side of the farmyard. I had no plan. I wondered whether, after all these years, there was anyone still living there, or, more precisely, if the Hempstocks were still living there. It seemed unlikely, but then, from what little I remembered, they had been unlikely people. The stench of cow muck struck me as I got out of the car, and I walked gingerly across the small yard to the front door. I looked for a doorbell, in vain, and then I knocked. The door had not been latched properly, and it swung gently open as I rapped it with my knuckles. I had been here, hadn't I, a long time ago? I was sure I had. Childhood memories are sometimes covered and obscured beneath the things that come later, like childhood toys forgotten at the bottom of a crammed adult closet. But they are never lost for good. I stood in the hallway and called, "Hello? Is there anybody here?" I heard nothing. I smelled bread baking and wax furniture polish and old wood. My eyes were slow to adjust to the darkness. I peered into it, was getting ready to turn and leave, when an elderly woman came out of the dim hallway holding a white duster. She wore her grey hair long. I said, "Mrs. Hempstock?" She tipped her head to one side, looked at me. "Yes, I do know you, young man," she said. I am not. It was reassuring. "Hold my hand," she repeated, "and don't do anything unless I tell you. You've got that?" I said, "I don't feel very safe." She did not argue. She said, "We've gone further than I imagined, further than I expected. I'm not really sure what kinds of things live out here on the margins." The trees ended, and we walked out into open country. I said, "Are we a long way from your farm?" "No, we're still on the borders of the farm. Hempstock Farm stretches a very long way. We brought a lot of this with us from the old country when we came here. The farm came with us and brought things with it when it came. Gran calls them fleas." I did not know where we were, but I could not believe we were still on the Hempstocks' land, no more than I believed we were in the world I had grown up in. The sky of this place was the dull orange of a warning light. The plants, which were spiky, like huge, ragged aloes, were a dark, silvery green and looked as if they had been beaten from gunmetal. The coin in my left hand, which had warmed to the heat of my body, began to cool down again, until it was as cold as an ice cube. My right hand held Letty Hempstock's hand as tightly as I could. She said, "We're here." I thought I was looking at a building at first, that it was some kind of tent as high as a country church, made of grey and pink canvas that flapped in the gusts of storm wind in that orange sky. A lopsided canvas structure, aged by weather and ripped by time. And then it turned, and I saw its face, and I heard something make a whimpering sound like a dog that had been kicked, and I realized that the thing that was whimpering was me. Its face was ragged, and its eyes were deep holes in the fabric. There was nothing behind it, just a grey canvas mask, huger than I could have imagined, all ripped and torn, blowing in the gusts of storm wind. Something shifted, and the ragged thing looked down at us. Letty Hempstock said, "Name yourself." There was a pause. Empty eyes stared down at us. Then a voice as featureless as the wind said, "I am the lady of this place. I have been here for such a long time, since before the little people sacrificed each other on the rocks. My name is my own, child, not yours. Now leave me be before I blow you all away." It gestured with a limb like a broken mainsail, and I felt myself shivering. Letty Hempstock squeezed my hand, and I felt braver. She said, "Ask you to name yourself, I did. I ain't heard more'n empty boasts of age and time. Now you tell me your name, and I ain't asking you a third time." She sounded more like a country girl than she ever had before. Perhaps it was the anger in her voice. Her words came out differently when she was angry. "No," whispered the grey thing flatly. Little girl, who's your friend?" Letty whispered, "Don't say nothing." I nodded, pressed my lips tightly together. "I am growing tired of this," said the grey thing, with a petulant shake of its ragged cloth arms. "Something came to me and pleaded for love and help. It told me how I could make all the things like it happy, that they are simple creatures and all any of them want is money, just money and nothing more, little tokens of work. If it had asked, I would have given them wisdom or peace, perfect peace." "None of that," said Letty Hempstock. "You've got nothing to give them that they want. Let them be." The wind gusted, and the gargantuan figure flapped with it, huge sails swinging, and when the wind was done the creature had changed position. Now it seemed to have crouched lower to the ground, and it was examining us like an enormous canvas scientist looking at two white mice. Two very scared white mice, holding hands. Letty's hand was sweating now. She squeezed my hand, whether to reassure me or herself, I did not know, and I squeezed her hand back. The ripped face, the place where the face should have been, twisted. I thought it was smiling. Perhaps it was smiling. I felt as if it was examining me, taking me apart, as if it knew everything about me, things I did not even know about myself. The girl holding my hand said, "If you ain't telling me your name, I'll bind you as a nameless thing, and you'll still be bound and tied and sealed like a polter or a shuck." She waited, but the thing said nothing, and Letty Hempstock began to say words in a language I did not know. Sometimes she was talking, and sometimes it was more like singing, in a tongue that was nothing I had ever heard or would ever encounter later in life. I knew the tune, though. It was a child's song, the tune to which we sang the nursery rhyme, "Girls and boys come out to play." That was the tune. But her words were older words. I was certain of that. And as she sang, things happened beneath the orange sky. The earth writhed and churned with worms, long, grey worms that pushed up from the ground beneath our feet. Something came hurtling at us from the centre mass of flapping canvas. It was a little bigger than a football. At school, during games, mostly I dropped things I was meant to catch or closed my hand on them a moment too late, letting them hit me in the face or the stomach. But this thing was coming straight at me and Letty Hempstock, and I did not think. I only did. I put both my hands out, and I caught the thing, a flapping, writhing mass of cobwebs and rotting cloth, and as I caught it in my hands, I felt something hurt me, a stabbing pain in the sole of my foot, momentary and then gone as if I had trodden upon a pin. Letty knocked the thing I was holding out of my hands, and it fell to the ground, where it collapsed into itself. She grabbed my right hand, held it firmly once more, and through all this, she continued to sing. I have dreamed of that song, of the strange words to that simple rhyme song, and on several occasions I have understood what she was saying in my dreams. In those dreams, I spoke that language too, the first language, and I had dominion over the nature of all that was real. In my dream, it was the tongue of what is, and anything spoken in it becomes real, because nothing said in that language can be a lie. It is the most basic building brick of everything. In my dreams, I have used that language to heal the sick and to fly. Once I dreamed I kept a perfect little bed and breakfast by the seaside, and to everyone who came to stay with me, I would say, in that tongue, "Be whole." And they would become a brick of everything. In my dreams, I have used that language to heal the sick and to fly. Once I dreamed I kept a perfect little bed and breakfast by the seaside, and to everyone who came to stay with me, I would say, in that tongue, "Be whole." And they would become a whole, not be broken people, not any longer, because I had spoken the language of shaping. And because Letty was speaking the language of shaping, even if I did not understand what she was saying, I understood what was being said. The thing in the clearing was being bound to that place for always, trapped, forbidden to exercise its influence on anything beyond its own domain. Letty Hempstock finished her song. In my mind, I thought I could hear the creature screaming, protesting, railing, but the place beneath that orange sky was quiet. Only the flapping of canvas and the rattle of twigs in the wind broke the silence. The wind died down. A thousand pieces of torn grey cloth settled on the black earth like dead things, or like so much abandoned laundry. Nothing moved. Letty said, "That should hold it." She squeezed my hand. I thought she was trying to sound bright, but she didn't. She sounded grim. "Let's take you home." We walked hand in hand through a wood of blue-tinged evergreens, and we crossed a lacquered red and yellow bridge over an ornamental pond. We walked along the edge of a field in which young corn was coming up like green grass planted in rows. We climbed a wooden stile hand in hand and reached another field planted with what looked like small reeds or furry snakes, black and white and brown and orange and grey and striped, all of them waving gently, curling and uncurling in the sun. "What are they?" I asked. "You can pull one up and see if you like," said Letty. I looked down. The furry tendril by my feet was perfectly black. I bent, grasped it at the base firmly with my left hand, and I pulled. Something came up from the earth and swung around angrily. My hand felt like a dozen tiny needles had been sunk into it. I brushed the earth from it and apologized, and it stared at me more with surprise and puzzlement than with anger. It jumped from my hand to my shirt. I stroked it, a kitten, black and sleek, with a pointed, inquisitive face, a white spot over one ear, and eyes of a peculiarly vivid blue-green. "At the farm, we get our cats the normal way," said Letty. "What's that?" "Big Oliver. He turned up at the farm back in pagan times. All our farm cats trace back to him." I looked at the kitten hanging on my shirt with tiny kitten claws. "Can I take it home?" I asked. "It's not an it, it's a she. Not a good idea taking anything home from these parts," said Letty. I put the kitten down at the edge of the field. She darted off after a butterfly, which floated up and out of her reach, then she scampered away without a look back. "My kitten was run over," I told Letty. "It was only little. The man who died told me about it, although he wasn't driving. He said they didn't see it." "I'm sorry," said Letty. We were walking beneath a canopy of apple blossom then, and the world smelled like honey. "That's the trouble with living things. Don't last very long. Kittens one day, old cats the next, and then just memories. and the memories fade and blend and smudge together. She opened a 5-bar gate, and we went through it. She let go of my hand. We were at the bottom of the lane, near the wooden shelf by the road with the battered silver milk churns on it. The world smelled normal. I said, "We're really back now." "Yes," said Letty Hempstock, "and we won't be seeing any more trouble from her." She paused. Big, wasn't she? And nasty. I've not seen one like that before. If I'd known she was going to be so old and so big and so nasty, I wouldn't have brung you with me. I was glad that she had taken me with her. Then she said, "I wish you hadn't let go of my hand. But still, you're all right, aren't you? Nothing went wrong. No damage done." I said, "I'm fine, not to worry. I'm a brave soldier." That was what my grandfather always said. Then I repeated what she had said. "No damage done." She smiled at me, a bright, relieved smile, and I hoped I had said the right thing. Chapter 5. That evening, my sister sat on her bed, brushing her hair over and over. She brushed it 100 times every night and counted each brush stroke. I did not know why. "What are you doing?" she asked. "Looking at my foot," I told her. I was staring at the sole of my right foot. There was a pink line across the center of the sole, from the ball of the foot almost to the heel, where I had stepped on a broken glass as a toddler. I remember waking up in my cot the morning after it happened, looking at the black stitches that hold the edges of the cut together. It was my earliest memory. I was used to the pink scar. The little hole beside it, in the arch of my foot, was new. It was where the sudden sharp pain had been, although it did not hurt. It was just a hole. I prodded it with my forefinger, and it seemed to me that something inside the hole retreated. My sister had stopped brushing her hair and was watching me curiously. I got up, walked out of the bedroom, down the corridor, to the bathroom at the end of the hall. I do not know why I did not ask an adult about it. I do not remember asking adults about anything except as a last resort. That was the year I dug out a wart from my knee with a penknife, discovering how deeply I could cut before it hurt, and what the roots of a wart looked like. In the bathroom cupboard, behind the mirror, was a pair of stainless steel tweezers, the kind with pointed sharp tips for pulling out wooden splinters, and a box of sticking plasters. I sat on the metal side of the white bathtub and examined the hole in my foot. It was a simple, small, round hole, smooth-edged. I could not see how deeply it went because something was in the way. Something was blocking it, something that seemed to retreat as the light touched it. I held my tweezers, and I watched. Nothing happened. Nothing changed. I put the forefinger of my left hand over the hole, gently blocking the light. Then I put the tip of the tweezers beside the hole, and I waited. I counted to 100, inspired, perhaps, by my sister's hairbrushing. Then I pulled my finger away and stabbed in with the tweezers. I caught the head of the worm, if that was what it was, by the tip, between the metal prongs, and I squeezed it, and I pulled. Have you ever tried to pull a worm from a hole? You know how hard they can hold on, the way they use their whole bodies to grip the sides of the hole? I pulled perhaps an inch of this worm, pink and grey, streaked like something infected, out of the hole in my foot, and then felt it stop. I could feel it inside my flesh, making itself rigid, unpullable. I was not scared by this. It was obviously just something that happened to people, like when the neighbor's cat, Misty, had worms. I had a worm in my foot, and I was removing the worm. I twisted the tweezers, thinking, I suspect, of spaghetti on a fork, winding the worm around the tweezers. It tried to pull back, but I turned it a little at a time until I could definitely pull no further. I could feel, inside me, the sticky plastic way that it tried to hold on like a strip of pure muscle. I leaned over as far as I could, reached out my left hand and turned on the bath's hot water tap, the one with the red dot in the center, and I let it run. The water ran for 3-4 minutes out of the tap and down the plug hole before it began to steam. When the water was steaming, I extended my foot to my right arm, maintaining pressure on the tweezers and on the inch of the creature that I had wound out of my body. Then I put the place where the tweezers were under the hot tap. The water splashed my foot, but my soles were barefoot hardened, and I scarcely minded. The water that touched my fingers scalded them, but I was prepared for the heat. The worm wasn't. I felt it flex inside me, trying to pull back from the scalding water, felt it loosen its grip on the inside of my foot. I turned the tweezers triumphantly, like picking the best scab in the world as the creature began to come out of me, putting up less and less resistance. I pulled at it, steadily, and as it went under the hot water, it slackened until the end. It was almost all out of me. I could feel it, but I was too confident, too triumphant and impatient, and I tugged too quickly, too hard, and the worm came off in my hand. The end of it that came out of me was oozing and broken, as if it had snapped off. Still, if the creature had left anything behind in my foot, it was tiny. I examined the worm. It was dark grey and light grey, streaked with pink, and segmented like a normal earthworm. Now it was out of the hot water. It seemed to be recovering. It wriggled, and the body that had been wrapped around the tweezers now dangled, writhing, although it hung from the head. Was it its head? How could I tell? Where I had pinched it? I did not want to kill it. I did not kill animals, not if I could help it. But I had to get rid of it. It was dangerous. I had no doubt of that. I held the worm above the bath's plug hole, where it wriggled under the scalding water. Then I let it go and watched it vanish down the drain. I let the water run for a while, and I washed off the tweezers. Finally, I put a small sticking plaster over the hole in the sole of my foot and put the plug in the bath to prevent the worm from climbing back up the open plug hole before I turned off the tap. I did not know if it was dead, but I did not think you came back from the drain. I put the tweezers back where I had got them from, behind the bathroom mirror. Then I closed the mirror and stared at myself. I wondered, as I wondered so often when I was that age, who I was, and what exactly was looking at the face in the mirror. If the face I was looking at wasn't me, and I knew it wasn't because I would still be me whatever happened to my face, then what was me, and what was watching? I went back to the bedroom. It was my night to have the door to the hallway open, and I waited until my sister was asleep and wouldn't tell on me, and then, in the dim light from the hall, I read a secret 7 mystery until I fell asleep. Chapter 6. An admission about myself. As a very small boy, perhaps 3 or 4 years old, I could be a monster. You were a little momza, several aunts told me, on different occasions, once I had safely reached adulthood and my dreadful infant deeds could be recalled with wry amusement. But I do not actually remember being a monster. I just remember wanting my own way. Small children believe themselves to be gods, or some of them do, and they can only be satisfied when the rest of the world goes along with their way of seeing things. But I was no longer a small boy. I was 7. I had been fearless, but now I was such a frightened child. The incident of the worm in my foot did not scare me. I did not talk about it. I wondered, though, the next day, whether people often got footworms, or whether it was something that had only ever happened to me, in the orange sky place on the edge of the Hempstocks farm. I peeled off the plaster on the sole of my foot when I awoke, and was relieved to see that the hole had begun to close up. There was a pink place where it had been, like a blood blister, but nothing more. I went down to breakfast, My mother looked happy. She said, "Good news, darling. I've got a job. They need an optometrist at Dixon's Opticians and they want me to start this afternoon. I'll be working 4 days a week." I did not mind. I would be fine on my own. "And I've got more good news. We have someone coming to look after you children while I'm away. Her name is Ursula. She'll be sleeping in your old bedroom at the top of the stairs. She'll be a sort of housekeeper. She'll make sure you children are fed, and she'll clean the house. Mrs. Wallery is having trouble with her hip, and she says it will be a few weeks before she can come back. It will be such a load off my mind to have someone here if Daddy and I are both working." "You don't have the money," I said. "You said you didn't have any money." "That's why I'm taking the optometrist job," she said. "And Ursula's looking after you for room and board. She needs to live locally for a few months. She phoned this morning. Her references are excellent." I hoped that she would be nice. The previous housekeeper, Gertruda, 6 months earlier, had not been nice. She had enjoyed playing practical jokes on my sister and me. She would short-sheet the beds, for example, which left us baffled. Eventually, we had marched outside the house with placards saying, "We hate Gertruda," and "We do not like Gertruda's cooking," and put tiny frogs in her bed, and she had gone back to Sweden. I took a book and went out into the garden. It was a warm spring day and sunny, and I climbed up a rope ladder to the lowest branch of the big beech tree, sat on it, and read my book. I was not scared of anything when I read my book. I was far away, in ancient Egypt, learning about Hathor and how she had stalked Egypt in the form of a lioness, and she had killed so many people that the sands of Egypt turned red, and how they had only defeated her by mixing beer and honey and sleeping draughts and dyeing this concoction red so she thought it was blood, and she drank it and fell asleep. Ra, the father of the gods, made her the goddess of love after that, so the wounds she had inflicted on people would now only be wounds of the heart. I wondered why the gods had done that. Why hadn't they just killed her when they had the chance? I liked myths. They weren't adult stories, and they weren't children's stories. They were better than that. They just were. Adult stories never made sense, and they were so slow to start. They made me feel like there were secrets. Masonic, mythic secrets to adulthood. Why didn't adults want to read about Narnia, about secret islands and smugglers and dangerous fairies? I was getting hungry. I climbed down from my tree and went to the back of the house, past the laundry room that smelled of laundry soap and mildew, past the little coal and wood shed, past the outside toilet where the spiders hung and waited, wooden doors painted garden green. In through the back door, along the hallway, and into the kitchen. My mother was in there with a woman I had never seen before. When I saw her, my heart hurt. I mean that literally, not metaphorically. There was a momentary twinge in my chest, just a flash, and then it was gone. My sister was sitting at the kitchen table, eating a bowl of cereal. The woman was very pretty. She had shortish, honey-blonde hair, huge grey-blue eyes, and pale lipstick. She seemed tall, even for an adult. "Darling, this is Ursula Monckton," said my mother. I said nothing. I just stared at her. My mother nudged me. "Hello," I said. "He's shy," said Ursula Monckton. "I am certain that once he warms up to me, we shall be great friends." She reached out a hand and patted my sister's mousy brown hair. My sister smiled a gap-toothed smile. "I like you so much," my sister said. Then she said to our mother and me, "When I grow up, I want to be Ursula Monckton." My mother and Ursula laughed. "You little dear," said Ursula Monckton. Then she turned to me, "And what about us, eh? Are we friends as well?" I just looked at her, all grown up and blonde, in her grey and pink skirt, and I was scared. Her dress wasn't ragged. It was just the fashion of the thing, I suppose, the kind of dress that it was. But when I looked at her, I imagined her dress flapping in that windless kitchen, flapping like the mainsail of a ship on a lonely ocean under an orange sky. I don't know what I said in reply, or if I even said anything, but I went out of that kitchen, although I was hungry, without even an apple. I took my book into the back garden, beneath the balcony, by the flower bed that grew beneath the television room window, and I read, forgetting my hunger in Egypt, with animal-headed gods who cut each other up and then restored one another to life again. My sister came out into the garden. "I like her so much," she told me. "She's my friend. Do you want to see what she gave me?" She produced a small grey purse, the kind my mother kept in her handbag for coins, that fastened with a metal butterfly clip. It looked like it was made of leather. I wondered if it was mouse skin. She opened the purse, put her fingers into the opening, came out with a large silver coin. Half a crown. "Look," she said. "Look what I got." I wanted a half a crown. No, I wanted what I could buy with half a crown. Magic tricks and plastic joke toys and books and, oh, so many things. But I did not want a little grey purse with a half a crown in it. "I don't like her," I told my sister. "That's only because I saw her first," said my sister. "She's my friend." I did not think that Ursula Monckton was anybody's friend. I wanted to go and warn Letty Hempstock about her, but what could I say? That the new housekeeper nanny wore grey and pink? That she looked at me oddly? I wished I had never let go of Letty's hand. Ursula Monckton was my fault, I was certain of it, and I would not be able to get rid of her by flushing her down a plug hole or putting frogs in her bed. I should have left then. Should have run away, fled down the lane the mile or so to the Hempstocks' farm, but I didn't. And then a taxi took my mother away to Dixon's Opticians, where she would show people letters through lenses and help them see more clearly. And I was left there with Ursula Monckton. She came out into the garden with a plate of sandwiches. "I've spoken to your mother," she said, a sweet smile beneath the pale lipstick. "And while I'm here, you children need to limit your travels. You can be anywhere in the house or in the garden, or I will walk with you to your friends, but you may not leave the property and simply go wandering." "Of course," said my sister. I did not say anything. My sister ate a peanut butter sandwich. I was starving. I wondered whether the sandwiches were dangerous or not. I did not know. I was scared that I would eat one, and it would turn into worms in my stomach, and that they would wriggle through me, colonizing my body until they pushed out of my skin. I went back into the house. I pushed the kitchen door open. Ursula Monckton was not there. I stuffed my pockets with fruit, with apples and oranges and hard brown pears. I took 3 bananas and stuffed them down my jumper and fled to my laboratory. My laboratory, that was what I called it, was a green-painted shed as far away from the house as you could get, built up against the side of the house's huge old garage. A fig tree grew beside the shed, although we had never tasted ripe fruit from the tree, only seen the huge leaves and the green fruits. I called the shed my laboratory because I kept my chemistry set in there. The chemistry set, a perennial birthday present, had been banished from the house by my father after I'd made something in a test tube. I had randomly mixed things together and then heated them until they had erupted and turned black with an ammoniac stench that refused to fade. My father had said that he did not mind my doing experiments, although neither of us knew what I could possibly have been experimenting on, but that did not matter. My mother had been given chemistry sets for her birthday, and see how well that had turned out. But he did not want them within smelling range of the house. I ate a banana and a pear, then hid the rest of the fruit beneath the wooden table. Adults follow paths. Children explore. Adults are content to walk the same way hundreds of times or thousands. Perhaps it never occurs to adults to step off the paths, to creep beneath rhododendrons, to find the spaces between fences. I was a child, which meant that I knew a dozen different ways of getting out of our property and into the lane, ways that would not involve walking down our drive. I decided that I would creep out of the laboratory shed, along the wall to the edge of the lawn, and then into the azaleas and bay laurels that bordered the garden there. From the laurels, I would slip down the hill and over the rusting metal fence that ran along the side of the lane. Nobody was looking. I ran, and I crept, and I got through the laurels, and I went down the hill, pushing through the brambles and the nettle patches that had sprung up since the last time I went that way. Ursula Monkton was waiting for me at the bottom of the hill just in front of the rusting metal fence. There was no way she could have got there without my seeing her, but she was there. She folded her arms and looked at me, and her grey and pink dress flapped in a gust of wind. "I believe," I said, "that you were not to leave the property." "I'm not," I told her, with a cockiness I knew I did not feel. Not even a little. "I'm still on the property. I'm just exploring." "You're sneaking around," she said. I said nothing. "I think you should be in your bedroom where I can keep an eye on you. It's time for your nap." I was too old for naps, but I knew that I was too young to argue, or to win the argument if I did. "Okay," I said. "Don't say okay," she said. "Say yes, Miss Monkton, or ma'am. Say yes, ma'am." She looked down at me with her blue-grey eyes, which put me in mind of holes rotted in canvas, and which did not look pretty at that moment. I said yes, ma'am, and hated myself for saying it. We walked together up the hill. "Your parents can no longer afford this place," said Ursula Monkton, "and they can't afford to keep it up. Soon enough they'll see that the way to solve their financial problems is to sell this house and its gardens to property developers. Then all of this," and this was the tangle of brambles, the unkempt world behind the lawn, "will become a dozen identical houses and gardens, and if you are lucky, you'll get to live in one. And if not, you will just envy the people who do. Will you like that?" I loved the house and the garden. I loved the rambling shabbiness of it. I loved that place as if it was a part of me, and perhaps in some ways it was. "Who are you?" I asked. "Ursula Monkton. I'm your housekeeper." I said, "Who are you really? Why are you giving people money?" "Everybody wants money," she said, as if it were self-evident. "It makes them happy. It will make you happy if you let it." We had come out by the heap of grass clippings, behind the circle of green grass that we called the fairy ring. Sometimes, when the weather was wet, it filled with vivid yellow toadstools. "Now," she said, "go to your room." I ran from her, ran as fast as I could across the fairy ring, up the lawn, past the rose bushes, past the coal shed, and into the house. Ursula Monkton was standing just inside the back door of the house to welcome me in, although she could not have got past me, I would have seen. Her hair was perfect, and her lipstick seemed freshly applied. "I've been inside you," she said. "So, a word to the wise. If you tell anybody anything, they won't believe you. And because I've been inside you, I'll know. And I can make it so you never say anything I don't want you to say to anybody. Not ever again." I went upstairs to the bedroom, and I lay on my bed. The place on the sole of my foot where the worm had been throbbed and ached, and now my chest hurt too. I went away in my head into a book. That was where I went whenever real life was too hard or too inflexible, I pulled down a handful of my mother's old books from when she was a girl, and I read about schoolgirls having adventures in the 1930s and 1940s. Mostly they were up against smugglers, or spies, or fifth columnists, whatever they were, and the girls were always brave, and they always knew exactly what to do. I was not brave, and had no idea what to do. I had never felt so alone. I wondered if the Hempstocks had a telephone. It seemed unlikely, but not impossible. Perhaps it had been Mrs. Hempstock who had reported the abandoned Minnie to the police in the first place. The phone book was downstairs. But I knew the number to call directory inquiries, and I only had to ask for anybody named Hempstock living at Hempstock Farm. There was a phone in my parents' bedroom. I got off the bed, went to the doorway, looked out. The upstairs hallway was empty. As quickly, as quietly as I could, I walked into the bedroom next to mine. The walls were pale pink, my parents' bed covered with a bedspread covered in its turn with huge printed roses. There were French windows to the balcony that ran along that side of the house. There was a cream-colored telephone on the cream and gilt nightstand beside the bed. I picked it up, heard the dull whirring noise of the dial tone, and dialed directory inquiries, my finger pulling the holes in the dial down, a 1, a 9, a 2, and I waited for the operator to come on the line and tell me the number of the Hempstocks farm. I had a pencil with me, and I was ready to write the telephone number down in the back of a blue cloth-bound book called Pansy Saves the School. The operator did not come on. The dialing tone continued, and over it I heard Ursula Monckton's voice saying, "Properly brought up young people would not even think about sneaking off to use the telephone. Would they?" I did not say anything, although I have no doubt she could hear me breathing. I put the handset down on the cradle and went back into the bedroom I shared with my sister. I sat on my bed and stared out of the window. My bed was pushed up hard against the wall, just below the window. I loved to sleep with the windows open. Rainy nights were the best of all. I would open my windows and put my head on my pillow and close my eyes and feel the wind on my face and listen to the trees sway and creak. There would be raindrops blown onto my face, too, if I was lucky, and I would imagine that I was in my boat on the ocean and that it was swaying with the swell of the sea. I did not imagine that I was a pirate or that I was going anywhere. I was just on my boat. But now it was not raining, and it was not night. All I could see through the window were trees and clouds and the distant purple of horizon. I had emergency chocolate supplies hidden beneath the large plastic Batman figurine I had acquired on my birthday, and I ate them. And as I ate them, I thought of how I had let go of Letty Hempstock's hand to grab the ball of rotting cloth, and I remembered the stabbing pain in my foot that had followed. "I brought her here," I thought, and I knew that it was true. Ursula Monckton wasn't real. She was a cardboard mask for the thing that had travelled inside me as a worm that had flapped and gusted in the open country under that orange sky. I went back to reading Pansy Saves the School. The secret plans to the airbase next door to the school were being smuggled out to the enemy by spies, who were teachers working on the school vegetable allotment. The plans were concealed inside hollowed-out vegetable marrows. "Great heavens!" said Inspector Davidson of Scotland Yard's renowned Smugglers and Secret Spies Division, the SSSD. "That is literally the last place we would have looked." "We owe you an apology, Pansy," said the stern headmistress, with an uncharacteristically warm smile and a twinkle in her eyes that made Pansy think perhaps she had misjudged the woman all this term. "You have saved the reputation of the school. Now, before you get too full of yourself, aren't there some French verbs you ought to be conjugating for Madame?" I could be happy with Pansy, in some part of my head, even while the rest of my head was filled with fear. I waited for my parents to come home. I would tell them what was happening. I would tell them. They would believe me. At that time, my father worked in an office, an hour's drive away. I was not certain what he did. He had a very nice, pretty secretary with a toy poodle, and whenever she knew we children would be coming in to see our father, she would bring the poodle in from home and we would play with it. Sometimes we would pass buildings and my father would say, "That's one of ours." But I did not care about buildings, so never asked how it was one of ours or even who we were. I lay on my bed, reading book after book, until Ursula Monckton appeared in the doorway of the room and said, "You can come down now." My sister was watching television downstairs in the television room. She was watching a program called How, a pop science and how things work show which opened with the hosts in Native American headdresses saying, "How," and doing embarrassing war whoops. I wanted to turn over to the BBC, but my sister looked at me triumphantly and said, "Ursula says it can stay on whatever I want to watch, and you aren't allowed to change it." I sat with her for a minute, as an old man with a moustache showed all the children of England how to tie fishing flies. I said, "She's not nice." "I like her. She's pretty." My mother arrived home 5 minutes later, called "Hello" from the corridor, then went into the kitchen to see Ursula Monckton. She reappeared. "Dinner will be ready as soon as Daddy gets home. Wash your hands." My sister went upstairs and washed her hands. I said to my mother, "I don't like her. Will you make her go away?" My mother sighed. "It is not going to be Gertruda all over again, dear. Ursula's a very nice girl from a very good family, and she positively adores the two of you." My father came home, and dinner was served. A thick vegetable soup, then roast chicken and new potatoes with frozen peas. I loved all of the things on the table. I did not eat any of it. "I'm not hungry," I explained. "I'm not one for telling tales out of school," said Ursula Monckton, "but someone had chocolate on his hands and face when he came down from his bedroom." "I wish you wouldn't eat that rubbish," grumbled my father. "It's just processed sugar, and it ruins your appetite and your teeth," said my mother. I was scared they would force me to eat, but they didn't. I sat there hungrily while Ursula Monckton laughed at all my father's jokes. It seemed to me that he was making special jokes just for her. After dinner, we all watched Mission Impossible. I usually liked Mission Impossible, but this time it made me feel uneasy as people kept pulling their faces off to reveal new faces beneath. They were wearing rubber masks, and it was always our heroes underneath, but I wondered what would happen if Ursula Monckton pulled off her face. What would be underneath that? We went to bed. It was my sister's night, and the bedroom door was closed. I missed the light in the hall. I lay in bed with the window open, wide awake, listening to the noises an old house makes at the end of a long day, and I wished as hard as I could, hoping my wishes could become real. I wished that my parents would send Ursula Monckton away, and then I would go down to the Hempstocks farm and tell Letty what I had done, and she would forgive me and make everything all right. I could not sleep. My sister was already asleep. She seemed able to go to sleep whenever she wanted to, a skill I envied and did not have. I left my bedroom. I loitered at the top of the stairs, listening to the noise of the television coming from downstairs. Then I crept barefoot silent down the stairs and sat on the third step from the bottom. The door to the television room was half open, and if I went down another step, whoever was watching the television could see me. So I waited there. I could hear the television voices punctuated by staccato bursts of TV laughter. And then, over the television voices, adults talking. Ursula Monckton said, "So is your wife away every evening?" My father's voice. No, she's gone back this evening to organise tomorrow. But from tomorrow it will be weekly. She's raising money for Africa in the village hall. For drilling wells, and I believe for contraception.
Well, said Ursula, I already know all about that.
She laughed, a high, tingling laugh, which sounded friendly and true and real and had no flapping rags in it. Then she said, Little pitchers. And a moment later, the door opened the whole way, and Ursula Monckton was looking straight at me. She had redone her makeup, her pale lipstick, and her big eyelashes. Go to bed, she said. Now. I want to talk to my dad, I said, without hope. She said nothing, just smiled, with no warmth in it and no love. And I went back up the stairs and climbed into my bed and lay in the darkened bedroom until I gave up on sleeping, and then sleep enveloped me when I was not expecting it. And I slept without comfort. Chapter 7. The next day was bad. My parents had both left the house before I woke. It had turned cold, and the sky was a bleak and charmless grey. I went through my parents' bedroom to the balcony that ran along the length of their bedroom and my sister's and mine, and I stood on the long balcony, and I prayed to the sky that Ursula Monckton would have tired of this game and that I would not see her again. Ursula Monckton was waiting for me at the bottom of the stairs when I went down. Same rules as yesterday, little pitcher, she said. You can't leave the property. If you try, I will lock you in your bedroom for the rest of the day, and when your parents come home, I will tell them you did something disgusting. They won't believe you. She smiled sweetly. Are you sure? If I tell them that you pulled out your little willy and whittled all over the kitchen floor and I had to mop it up and disinfect it, I think they'll believe me. I'll be very convincing. I went out of the house and down to my laboratory. I ate all the fruit that I'd hidden there the day before. I read Sandy Sees It Through, another of my mother's books. Sandy was a plucky but poor schoolgirl who was accidentally sent to a posh school where everybody hated her. In the end, she exposed the geography teacher as an international Bolshevik who had tied the real geography teacher up. The climax was in the school assembly when Sandy bravely got up and made a speech which began, I know I should not have been sent here. It was only an error in paperwork that sent me here and sent Sandy, spelled with a Y, to the town grammar school. But I thank Providence that I came here, because Miss Striebling is not whom she claims to be. In the end, Sandy was embraced by the people who had hated her. My father came home early from work, earlier than I remembered seeing him home in years. I wanted to talk to him, but he was never alone. I watched them from the branch of my beech tree. First he showed Ursula Monckton around the gardens, proudly showing her the rose bushes and the black currant bushes and the cherry trees and the azaleas, as if he had anything to do with them, as if they'd not been put in place and tended by Mr. Wallery for 50 years before ever we had bought the house. She laughed at all his jokes. I could not hear what he was saying, but I could see the crooked smile he had when he knew he was saying something funny. She was standing too close to him. Sometimes he would rest his hand on her shoulder in a friendly sort of way. It worried me that he was standing so close to her. He didn't know what she was. She was a monster, and he just thought she was a normal person, and he was being nice to her. She was wearing different clothes today, a grey skirt of the kind they called a midi, and a pink blouse. On any other day, if I had seen my father walking around the garden, I would have run over to him. But not that day. I was scared that he would be angry, or that Ursula Monckton would say something to make him angry with me. I became terrified of him when he was angry. His face, angular and usually affable, would grow red, and he would shout so loudly and furiously that it would literally paralyze me. I would not be able to think. He never hit me. He did not believe in hitting. He would tell us how his father had hit him, how his mother had chased him with a broom, how he was better than that,